I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kevin Middleton, and I'm here with Samantha Berg. And tonight we are going to unpack the great secrets of an Alaskan master gardener with Ellen Vandevis, author of Ask Mother Nature, A Conscious Gardener's Guide, and she's the owner of Good Earth Garden School. And we want to explore everything you need to know and what you need to do to get your organic, life-sustaining garden prepped and ready for spring using sustainable practices. And we want to hear from you, so join our conversation by typing your questions or comments on the Bridge to Everywhere Facebook page, and we'll be checking that throughout the show.
And before we introduce Ellen, do you like to be called Ellie or Ellen?
Which
doesn't matter. Okay, I like calling you Ellie, so I'm going to call you Ellie. I'd like to give our listeners a little bit of information about Ellie. So Ellie Vandevis, MS, was somewhere in her shady past an environmental education consultant in West Michigan for 20 school districts and a developer of a nature center. In Alaska, she has played in the soil as an organic market gardener, both in her own Good Earth Gardens and then for the kitchens of the National Outdoor Leadership School Alaska branch. Ellie is also fond of all things decaying and is known in the Mattsu Valley as the Compost Queen. She has been, we need some regal music accompanying that, the Compost Queen. She has been known to mysteriously brew compost tea for farmers and farmers markets. She consults on compost tea and eco agriculture growing systems. Since 1987, she has been training folks on how to farm and garden using organic methods. Teaching topics include selecting organic fertilizers, managing pests non-toxically, building living soil, composting successfully, growing lush flowers, lawns, and herbs, and raising nutrient-dense vegetables. She instructs through her own Good Earth Garden School, as well as credit courses through University of Alaska Anchorage, Mattsu College, and Alaska Pacific University. Ellie also offers various workshops that combine the science and the spiritual methods of organic growing. These classes utilize the Findhorn Paralindra style. Close. Paralindra. Findhorn and Paralindra style of communication and co-creation with nature, and are based on her book, Ask Mother Nature, A Conscious Gardener's Guide. To learn more about the classes Ellie instructs or to host a class in your community, visit www.ellenvandevis.com. That's ellenvandevisse.com. So, Ellie, welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
And before we let her speak, we do want to promote an upcoming class that's going to be happening at Alaska Center for Acupuncture at 6:30 next Wednesday evening. That's April 3rd. And that's going to be a whole class on worms and vermicomposting.
And that's free. So
that
it's just
a free
call
class.
Our office and sign right up.
So you can call 745-8688 to sign up for that, and that's from 6:30 to 8 at Alaska Center for Acupuncture. Everything you wanted to know about worms and some things that you probably didn't know you wanted to know about worms with Ellie Vandevis. So welcome to the show, Ellie. Great to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
So what shall we talk about first?
Maybe just talk about your philosophy. What's the underpinning philosophy of your book, of your workshops, and your message?
I started Good Earth Garden School simply because I saw a need for people to get good information about how to garden organically in Alaska, which is quite a challenge, and to start on a path of sustainability with good, solid science information. And for those who are ready to combine that with the spiritual aspects of working closely with nature and the spirits of nature.
That sounds great. Let's say more about that. So I noticed that's one of the series of classes that you offer at the Good Earth Garden School is spiritual gardening. So let's talk about that. What kind of classes does one take when you take a spiritual gardening class?
Well, some would argue that all gardening is spiritual.
I would argue that.
Gosh, you're out there in the beautiful out of doors feeling great and your hands are in the soil and you feel grounded and you've forgotten all about your day's troubles.
Well, you have two classes listed under spiritual gardening. You've got Ask Mother Nature, Gardening with Spirit, and then you also have Pranic Gardens and Communication Through the Veils. So that sounds pretty exciting.
The Ask Mother Nature is a discussion of things that I have learned in my process of gardening, Findhorn style, and it's based on the book that I wrote. But I'll be sharing some new stories about, making deals with pests, working with weeds, learning how to get the best out of old seed that has low germination rates, and actually calling back the spirit or deva of that variety and asking that it imbue the seeds with its spirit again and getting better germination rates.
So seed resurrection is what I'm hearing. Well, but not Franken seeds.
Almost Easter and still in that same spirit.
Bringing the seeds
so
back.
So can anybody do this? Or, I mean, is it hard? Is there kind of training goes with that?
It's the same thing that we think about in our daily lives. Can I be more recognizing of people's goodness, respect, recognizing they have needs, and that in creation can extend to red wigglers and old dead seed packets and a pile of weeds you want to chop. Why not acknowledge the God in all of creation and speak as fellow magnificent spirits and seek cooperation, seek a good solution so everybody wins without having to resort to this idea that it's me against you, we have to fight. It's a combat out there in the garden.
We actually had a physicist on the show a while back when we talked about how we really are all connected. You know, we talked about the physics and the science of it, you know, that every single hydrogen atom that's in you was created at the moment of the Big Bang, and they're all 13.7 billion plus years old, and the same hydrogen atoms that are in you are in me and also in your garden. And then if you want to take it a step further, the denser atoms that are required to create life, like oxygen, which we breathe, and which the plants breathe in carbon dioxide and then breathe out oxygen for us to breathe, and the carbon that's in us and is also in the plants, all of that is created in supernovas.
And it's so eternal. It does not actually age.
Right.
It's actually eternal.
Right.
Yeah.
So basically, suns have to explode in order for us to all be here, and we're all part of that process. So I am part of a supernova, as you are, as are all the pests in
and
your
the
garden.
Weeds, yeah.
And the weeds, and all the seeds, and the soil,
you
and
can
everything
see a
else.
See dandelion and a new light from that standpoint.
Uh-huh. Yep. New appreciation for a dandelion.
So what you're really describing is
Can I say something about dandelion while we're on dandelion?
Yeah.
One of the better-known herbalists, Stephen Buhner, contends that he can tell what's going on in your personal life and your status in your health just by what's growing around your yard. Why? Because a walk around might reveal a lot of dandelions, which says, we're here. We can see that we can help. We are the best liver builder, liver healer you've got. We're here, we're here, we're here to help. You see us as weeds, but we're here to help.
I love dandelion for that reason. it's a fantastic liver herb. When we've had Stella Lynn on the program in the past, and I believe Susan Weed has a word for those herbs. She calls them back porch herbs. So she always talks about how the things that are growing right around you, like right in your backyard, are the things that you most need. And so and I always find it hilarious that those are the things that we want to dump poison on and rip them out of the yard. But those are the things that are often very nutritious. Nettles is another one, really nutritious plant growing right in your backyard. Chickweed is another one that a lot of gardeners have issues with. You have any feelings about chickweed?
Oh, it's one of the best skin tonics ever. So Jana Schofield, the author of Discovering Wild Plants, is coming back to teach all summer all over Alaska, and she can show you how to make tinctures, salves, lotions, and there's several other classes you'll see listed on the Good Earth Garden School website Sam told you ellenvandevis.com, but it's a lot easier to remember goodearthgardenschool.com. You'll see just a whole host of classes about how you can easily use those weeds like chickweed to make luscious lotions and tonics and keep yourself healthy with none of the side effects that we worry about with prescription drugs.
I know Janice has a fantastic story in one of her books. I think it's the pocket guide that she has that goes to the larger book that she's got on plants, and it's about going for a hike with a friend who gets blood poisoning, and they chew up some plantain and put it on the wound, and they actually saw the blood poisoning reversed with the plantain. It just sucked the stuff out of there, which was always amazing to me. So that when they were out basically in the middle of nowhere, and they were able to, instead of having to panic and run to the nearest hospital, they just found some plantain on the ground and slapped it on there and good to go.
So you gardeners are thinking about your flowers and vegetables and culinary herbs, but as you can gather from this conversation, we want your presence on the lawn, hands and knees, looking for plantain and looking for bits of yarrow, looking for bits of all kinds of things that you'll be harvesting as well if you would like to enhance your health and have a whole new learning experience.
Mm-hmm. Along those lines, you were talking about making friends with some of your garden pests, as you talk about in the book. Could you say more about that?
One of the things that hits your coal crops is a thing called a cabbage root maggot. And they eat away on the roots of your young broccoli transplants and so forth. The larva form does. And it was really that cabbage root maggot that taught me, Ellen, either don't plant everything all together, because it's just a whole cafeteria for us. We go from one broccoli to another, and it's great. We have all we want to eat. So either don't plant that or protect your bed full of broccoli with a row cover, which is a spun polyester barrier that keeps the adult insect from coming in and laying the eggs that start the cycle.
So you put the row cover down after you put seeds in and poke little holes for the broccoli to come through?
Oh, it's actually a little tent that mm-hmm. you put over the plants.
Oh, okay.
And where do you find that? With like Lowe's or Home
right
Depot?
Right at Budget Feeds in Palmer and through all the catalogs. It has various names. Agribon, Rime, Spun Polyester Row Cover. It's at Alaska Mill and Feed as well. It looks like what you would see if you looked under your couch and saw that white fabric that okay. keeps the stuffing in. But if you seal that around your coal crops, the adult can't get in. But if there's one little hole or one little gap, they'll find a way in and lay their eggs.
And it's white, is it?
It is white, yeah.
Okay.
It comes in different thicknesses, and it's also frost protection. The thicker it is, the more degrees of frost protection you'll get from this little tent as well.
So part of dealing with the pests is knowing if something is coming in from underneath, in from the soil, or something's coming down, like flying down and landing and laying eggs, right?
Yeah, insects are very good at finding their particular host plant by reading the electromagnetic fields. So another way to mix up a pest is to interplant. Instead of being stuck on straight rows with all the same thing in one row, all the broccoli in one row, and all the cabbage in one row, mix it up. Plant some flowers, plant some beets, plant some carrots, and then plant another broccoli so that you have this beautiful array of color. The demand on the soil nutrients is not as great because you're mixing up heavy feeders and light feeders, as we call them. And a pest comes along. If you've got some onions or chives or leeks in that, they maybe can find one or two, but they won't find them all because they're all camouflaged every place, mixed in with everything else. It doesn't make harvesting as easy, but it sure does foil your your pests.
That's really an innovative idea. I kind of have to think that there's some – I think of people out there that I know who are very organized and very methodical, and so they like to have everything in perfect rows. And if you think about it, well, if you'd like to do it that way, then you may be ringing the dinner gong for the particular pest that likes that thing. So,
exactly.
So having a little mixer party and mixing things up a little bit, even though it's not as easy for you and doesn't seem as aesthetically pleasing depending on what you find aesthetically. Like for me, that sounds great. Mishmash, let's do it. But if you're willing to sacrifice some of that neatness, you may actually end up with vegetables or, you know, more harvest in the long run because you're confusing the pests a little bit. Yes.
I want to say more about that too, because you know, the mindset, you know, traditional or common mindset is to create a garden that's beautiful, everything really look and clean, neat rows, and everything grows in the right way, and you have a bountiful crop. And there's a certain forcing our will on nature to try to produce that, and we'll use all means to do that, whether, you know, chemical or otherwise. And you're really presenting a very different philosophy, a very different approach. And is it at odds with creating a beautiful garden that's well kept and predictable with its outcomes? Or does a person have to be holding that a little bit loosely for the sake of sustainability?
And gardeners, can you step back and challenge your sense of beauty? Are you an English tidy person who wants everything in straight rows? Or can you accept compliments for interplanting with a few flowers here and there within your beds and the beauty of different colors and textures? There's a special beauty there. If you're a permaculture person or thinking about learning about permaculture, that is central, that you mix everything up like nature does and try to make more of a community. So can you even think in circles instead of rows? There was a researcher during World War II in Brazil, perhaps, one of the South American countries. He was researching crops and how to get the most yield. He did not have time to grow out and methodically, mathematically test each theory. They had to quickly become self-sufficient because the war was on. They couldn't import a lot of grains or other foods. He began planting in circles. Nature seems to work in circles, not straight lines. And what he found was he got much higher yield in circles. So he's challenging us to change our irrigation systems a little, the equipment we put on our plows for commercial production. Change the shape, get a little bit more yield.
I'm thinking now I understand crop circles. Those messages from the aliens, they're trying to tell us how exactly to plant our plants. That's what the message is. You just like solve the whole mystery for me. So,
and we're not getting it.
And we're not getting it. I mean, it's so simple. Like crop circle. It's great. You hear that, everyone? It's a crop circle. It's actually the pattern that you're supposed to plant your plants in.
I love it.
That's awesome. So, shall we talk a little bit about?
I want to know what to do with about our strawberries and the birds first.
What's your strawberry? Keep the strawberries safe from the birds solution. We've had several people talk to us, and we'll mention what we've heard. But what do you do?
Yeah, and I want to do this in a way that so I understand if we're communicating with the birds in a relationship kind of way, or are we just thinking strategies that to think like birds think and then come up with a trick? Or do we just cover the things with the same cloth?
The easy answer is simply cover them with the row covers. Same as a commercial grower would do when they really can't mix it up and still get money out of their expensive field labor. So they use those row covers and tuck them in real well and plant monocultures. But there's a great line from the classic book, The Findhorn Garden, in which the birds say to the humans, "Do you want to increase your faith? Ask us to work with you. Tell us which berries are ours and which are yours, and watch and see what happens. So at this community in Findhorn, Scotland, sure enough, they did. They said, these are yours, these are ours. And those birds, all manner of berry-eating birds, ate theirs and didn't eat the humans.
And how did they make it clear to the birds that these are yours and these are ours?
Telepathy and saying it out loud and having a clear designation in the human mind and probably marking it for the garden workers as well so they don't get upset about the birds in some of the berry patches. They probably labeled them.
So I don't know. The kinds of things that people have suggested to us were pinwheels in the strawberry garden. And
painting rocks.
We had one guy who he employed his grandkids to early, just before the strawberries would get ripe, he would have his grandkids go into the garden and paint small rocks red so that it would confuse the birds and they would learn that the strawberries in this garden were not particularly edible and so they would move on. I thought that was kind of innovative.
Ingenious.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good. But you're not really hurting the birds, you know, unless you're making them small enough that the birds can eat. But what occurred to me with something like strawberries growing every year in the same bed. So is the plant matter from the strawberries that's going back into the soil, is that enough to keep things going, or do you have to add things to your strawberry beds, do you find?
Well, it's all on observation and soil tests. If you see that your production is going down and the plants are looking not as green-leafed as you would like, or the berries just don't seem to be what you would like, probably a application of fishbone meal and scratch it in where you can without disturbing the roots would be a great boost.
And does the rain kind of bring it in deeper to the roots then?
A lot of the soil organisms will work it into the soil too. So even though there it is sitting on the surface and you think that's not right, the roots will come up to it and also the organisms will work it down. If you're not using our wonderful local fish bone meal, thanks to the Gregs, you might mix up some liquid fish, Alaska fish emulsion, or one of the fish hydrolysates, the stinky liquid fish. Follow the directions, mix it up, and water that in. That will help.
And do you do that in May? Are you thinking of this in a very specific time period that's best?
Oh, if you establish a new bed, you can prepare the soil before you ever put strawberry plants in. If you're talking about a bed that's 3, 4, 5 years old, maybe it needs a perking up, that's when I'm talking about applying the on-top fertilizers.
So you wouldn't need
to
do
that. And that could be midsummer if you wanted. It could be after the blooming. It could be any old time.
But the strawberries won't taste like fish.
No, it's amazing how fast that stuff changes.
That's awesome.
The microbes just put it right into the forms the plants want.
And last question on strawberries. Do you have to pull, I've heard some say that you need to actually pull out certain plants, like the mother plants, after a certain number of seasons. There's some kind of trimming out that you need to do in the patch. Is that true?
That sounds like a cooperative extension question to me.
Okay.
I don't know.
So let's talk a little bit about what you're up to right now in the early spring, even though it doesn't look like early spring out there today. I'm pretty sure it's spring. I heard a rumor that the groundhog was arrested and possibly about to be hanged for predicting in early spring. But what should we be thinking about right now? I know a lot of people have already started plants in their homes, or they're maybe thinking about it. Some people get plant starts going really early, but what kinds of things are you up to right now?
All my windowsills and card tables and light banks are full of flats of seedlings. We don't have a long enough season in Alaska for some things to actually grow and harvest. If you wait to put all your seeds in the ground in late May, some things will never mature. So it's good to have transplants growing now that give you a head start. There's a wonderful guide to what you start when, 10 to 12 weeks ahead, 8 to 10 weeks ahead, 4 to 6 weeks ahead, 3 weeks ahead. And that's a cooperative extension bulletin. It's on their website, and it's a guide to.
How does one get to the cooperative extension website? I guess we could just Google Matsu Cooperative Extension, and that would get us there. And so they've got a publication on what things need to be started when, so you get them in the ground and actually get some kind of a yield.
Yes.
Okay.
Guide to Alaska Transplants or something close to that. I just lost my notes.
That's okay.
You know, the other thing I wanted to ask about is, you can talk to friends and say, oh, yeah, we grow everything organic. But organic means different things to different people. And I'm wondering if you have some clear definitions for folks, what you consider an actual organic garden and what you would, what you're thinking about in terms of handling the soil and putting in amendments and how you would do it differently than somebody who's actually growing non-organic.
Some people think if they just add a little manure to the garden, that makes it organic. The more strict definition is no chemical fertilizers such as 8-32-16 or 10-20-20, and no pesticides that are harmful to soil and humans or birds or bugs. If you're growing for selling to other people, if you're growing vegetables or flowers and you want to say they're organic, you can certify organic, and then you have to follow quite a nice list of rules and have an inspection and then pay a fee, and you've earned your certification. If you're selling and your profits are under $5,000, then you can still call yourself organic and you don't have to do the paperwork and the formal certification.
Does the certification involve a soil test to see if there are any soil residues from past use of pesticides or herbicides or anything like that?
That's the idea, to make sure there's no residues. Mm-hmm. A lot of growers are going to another kind of certification that they created called Certified Naturally Grown, or some other invention that keeps very high standards but without the expense of having to go through the paperwork of every vegetable you grow and pay for the arugula, the beets, the cabbage, the lettuce, the parsnips, every last one.
And for a small, even somebody who's, $5,000 is very small, but somebody who's generating, even $10,000 or $15,000 or $30,000, that's still a lot of work to go for each vegetable. So it would make sense that some people, maybe there may be some people around here who are growing, to very high standards, but they just haven't gone for the certification. So interesting.
On that note, we're going to take a brief break here. And when you come back, we're listening to the Compost Queen, Ellen Vandevis. And if you have questions, I really would love to hear from you. Just go to Facebook page, Bridge to Everywhere, and we'll ask your question on the air. And we'll be right back.
KVRF Sutton, Radio Free Palmer. 89.5 on your FM dial, Big Cabbage Radio.
Hi, welcome back to Bridge to Everywhere. You're listening to Sam and Kevin. We're having a discussion with Ellie Vandevis, the compost queen. And we were just talking a little bit about what makes your garden organic and what kinds of things you can put on your garden if you wish to grow an organic garden and what kinds of things you would not want to put on your garden.
What kind of amendments do you like to use, in your course of gardening?
Well, first of all, I like to have some kind of assessment, a soil test, and I like to send it to a lab like the ones I've listed on my website, which give you a much more complete and whole picture of what's going on with your soil rather than just the major three nutrients, the mega nutrients, NPK, or nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. So I want to know, what's my level of organic matter? Do I have some trace elements in there? How's my calcium levels and magnesium levels? Those are critical to plant health. And then I like to share what I've learned in all my years here, finding what's local and what's really high quality. So we are very blessed to have the Greggs making us fish bone meal. They grind fish bone waste that they ship from Kodiak. So it's got some fish guts and a lot of fish bones. So when you hear the word bone, you think, ah, calcium, phosphorus. When you hear fish guts, you think, oh, well, that's some nitrogen too. And a fish has been in the ocean. It's had access to all manner of trace elements too. So that would mean there's some boron and selenium and all those other things we need, just a tiny bit of, but we need it if we're going to have a full whole system of health for ourselves, and the plant needs the same. And so it has to go into the soil, and then the microorganisms have to process this so that it's useful and in a way the roots can use it and take it up and the plants can use it.
So that microorganisms in the soil also, they work symbiotically with the roots of the plants. And I know that you can there's a theory, well, we just throw as much of a particular nutrient in there. So if there's a lot of it, then the plant can, you know, there'll be more for the plant to utilize. But we can actually kill some of these microorganisms or burn them by adding too much of, let's say, nitrogen into the soil. And so we kind of get the opposite effect of what we're looking for. If you put too much of something into the soil, you can inhibit the plant from being able to utilize it.
Exactly. Correct? Yes. That's our little check on ourselves. If we go with this thought of, oh, if a little is good, then a lot must be better. I'm going to pour it on. You will cause all kinds of problems. You may even kill your crops. The amendments I like, if you're not using fish bone meal, the liquid fish that I mentioned, fish emulsion or fish hydrolysate, are both liquid forms of mashed up fish. Those feed the microorganisms like your bacteria and your fungi. And Sam, you're right. Down there in the roots, bacteria are all around your roots doing wonderful things to the soil. Their sticky excretions bind the soil together nicely, and so it doesn't just fall apart in your hand. The fungi are reaching out with long, long mycelia, reaching for nutrients way beyond the root zone and bringing in moisture as well. Those are the guys we want. They're beneficial. There's only a few fungi and bacteria that cause disease, and they can hardly get in if you've got a healthy soil with the beneficial bacteria and fungi. So you feed them and keep them healthy with your compost, your grass clippings and leaves that you perhaps mulch with, or your organic amendments like the fish bone meal and fish and kelp. Those are the things that really give you the health
and you're even,
pass on the nutrition.
You're feeding probiotics to the soil. There's something that you told us about. We were calling it jubilate. I don't know how you act. Jubilate.
Jubilate.
Jubilate. I don't know how you say it. But in each, when we learned from you to put our seeds in, we were sprinkling a little bit of this probiotic into the little hole where we were poking our seeds.
Exactly.
So you're even encouraging the microorganism content of the soil. And we've got a real problem in this country with nutrients in the soil. Even back into the 30s and the 40s, the information was coming back that we were losing nutrients. I know we're losing topsoil at a pretty incredible rate. But now a tomato is not a tomato. Like a tomato that you buy in the supermarket does not have the same nutrients as a tomato that you might have got around the turn of the century. You know, the same thing with an apple or the same thing with broccoli, depending on whether you're buying organic or whether you're buying your standard commercial level. There's definitely a difference between organic produce and the standard produce in the supermarket. But even so, even the organic grown on a large commercial scale doesn't seem to have the nutrients that we need. So, you know, and especially for people who are trying to get all their nutrients from food, it's a bit of a challenge because the nutrients are just not there. They've been depleted out of the soil. So besides the amendments, what other kinds of things are you doing to ensure that your soil is nutrient dense? How are you rotating crops around? What other things are you adding to the soil?
Two things. With that soil test that shows more of a complete profile.
And this is a soluble soil test?
If you just want to go to the local cooperative extension, you can get a $40 test that will tell you about NPK and pH. If you go to International Ag Labs or several of the others that I list on the website, they'll give you more of a profile of how your trace minerals and your other meganutrients are doing. And that'll show you as you build up with your compost and build up with your fish and kelp or whatever, that you're finally building the boron in that isn't in our soils natively. In South Central, there's quite a deficit of boron. So that addresses that whole national crisis that you mentioned of a tremendous nutrient deficit. So when you build nutrient density, you're looking at the probiotics that you mentioned, inoculating with the friendly, beneficial bacteria, fungi, protozoans, nematodes. You're looking at giving it the right amendments, but not too much, just the right amount. Maybe a mid-season boost. Kelp is just, I think, got 33 trace elements in it, for example. You're slowly building up nutrient density. In the meantime, we still need to take supplements because we're still not getting all that we need.
I tell the humans to eat the kelp anyway.
Yeah.
So soak your grains with kelp. I eat a little bit with breakfast. I eat a little bit at dinner. I just chop it up and eat kelp chips. You know, if you can't get your family to eat it, you can get powdered kelp. You can sneak it into things. If you're really kamikaze, I get a bladder rack that's coarse ground from Maine Coast Sea Veggies at seaveg.com. And I make a tea out of it and I let it sit overnight and then I hold my nose and I drink it.
This is like drinking low tide.
Yep,
it's really
it tastes like
potent.
Drinking low tide, but it's full. It's full of minerals. And so, yes, I mean, but so in a, so at least you're still
getting
it. I'm
usually dizzy for about 10 minutes after I drink that stuff.
Yeah, but it's a way to get minerals from actual food, and that's what I'm always striving to do, you know, from, you know, if I'm
food is the most natural way to get the right chemical combination. We can't just take in straight elements. If we could, we could just grow roots. But
right. Yeah, I'm just going to plant myself in the soil now and see what happens.
You know, and it's such... You know, it's such an important message for folks to hear because in this culture, you know, blend it in, you know, get a powder that has all the essential nutrients, supposedly a dried powder, blend it in the morning with some fruit juice, and supposedly you have a nutritious meal to last you the rest of the first half of the day. And that's the mindset that commonly we hear in our treatment room is just the mindset that, well, it says I've got this much protein, I've got this much carbs, I've got this much sugars, so therefore I'm set. But you can't tell me that little shake from a powder is going to give you the same kind of nourishing power as if you had fresh kale and you had, you know, some celery and you had, you know, some carrot and you blended all that together with some
plenty
organic.
Plenty fresh. The enzymes are still intact. It hasn't been shipped and then sat in the store for 10 days or whatever.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, and that requires effort. You know, that's the thing, is that in order to create this garden that's going to give something back to you, you do have to put something into the garden. And so there is quite a bit of work up front. And I know in Alaska that can involve quite a bit more work because it's hard to grow certain things. I think we celebrated the first year we got a squash. It was really exciting for us to get a squash. We want to know what
the taste and the freshness are the payoffs.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know exactly what's in your food.
Mm-hmm. You know, there seems to be a renaissance going, you know, with small farming, community-supported agriculture, and in inner-city urban settings where people are just finding ways to grow things on their deck, on their balcony, in the grassy patch, you know, on this next to the sidewalk. I even saw that in downtown Anchorage this summer where people had little grassy patches next to the sidewalk in downtown where they just started growing lettuce and carrots and things. So maybe do you have anything to offer folks who maybe don't have a lot of growing space, innovative ways to just start growing anything, herbs, salad, greens, that might be easy place to start?
I want you to be a food rebel. tear up your lawn and make a garden. If you can't do that, then can you put a whiskey barrel on your deck? Can you get some 5-gallon buckets and put some soil in those and some drain holes in the bottom? Even large black pots will do. I have a friend who has grown his salad every year by putting it on the steps of the apartment, putting about 3 plants per pot, a Swiss chard and a romaine lettuce and a leaf lettuce, and then picking outer leaves while the plant keeps maturing. And then along about late July, it's time to put some new young plants in there again. But for a long time, you can just keep picking the outer ones. Do something to have something live. It's just so fun, and the taste is so great, and you feel so virtuous.
I was thinking George Carlin has this thing that he does. He talks about cemeteries and golf courses, and they're basically lawns. And so I kind of wonder about all of the green space that we have that's devoted to growing lawns when it could be growing a vegetable garden or growing, you know, an urban vegetable garden. Like, what if everybody used, even on a zero lot line house, if everybody took back most of that space that's devoted to lawns so that your homeowners association can get your property value up, and we changed that and started to grow food instead of lawns, how much abundance there would be in this country in terms of food. So, and how much healthier people would be. It's amazing to think about it.
Well, first of all, you wouldn't have that 10-20-20 fertilizer or 22-11-11 fertilizer that goes on lawns leaching through to groundwater or running off over the curb and into the Cook Inlet, fertilizing algae and killing things we want, like salmon. And second of all, it's my belief that every neighborhood has a green thumb person. Every neighborhood has somebody enthusiastic about composting. And every neighborhood doesn't have everybody who loves to garden. So, you gardeners, look at what you got for friends and neighbors. Can you grow for a few others? And occasionally they can help you with a harvest, but we won't expect everybody to be a grower. But you can. And start talking to that landlord or the condo association. See what you can work up and make it beautiful while you're at it.
We've had the similar conversation with the rebel gardeners before about how you just really can strike up a conversation with your neighbors. Like, hey, I noticed you're growing a lot of rhubarb, and we don't have rhubarb, and so we would like some of your rhubarb, and we're happy to trade with you for whatever it is that we're growing a lot of. But that's exactly it. I mean, this could create communities. You know, people in neighborhoods who never talk to each other all of a sudden can be getting together and trading. Oh, this person has horses. And, of course, I know there's an issue with horse manure. If people are deworming their horses, so you want to be careful about putting that stuff on the soil. But
be really selective with the horse manure.
Exactly.
That you use.
Selective horse manure. Yeah. But yeah, trading, you know, that if you see what your neighbors have, I mean, you could have a central garden tool exchange. You know, not everybody needs every single garden tool in their particular house. You know, no, you use the rototiller. I mean, I know some people are even against rototillers if they're doing more of a permaculture kind of setup. But I mean, not everybody needs every single tool at every single moment. So having some sort of central location where people can share tools, you know, and so getting really creative in your own neighborhood and taking advantage of the space that's available. I know when I was growing up, my mom was friends with somebody at the apartment across the street. We lived in an apartment that was on asphalt. I mean, there were these little patches of grass between the sidewalk and the street. And behind one of my mom's friend's apartments, there was this little patch of grass, probably no bigger than the room that we're sitting in right now. I don't know, it's 10 by 12, something like that. And so my mom got together with this friend of hers, and they paid somebody to rototill it, and they checked in with the landlord, and he said, go for it. And they actually grew a garden there in the back of this apartment in the midst of all of the asphalt.
Ah.
So it's totally doable.
Yeah.
There's something so satisfying about growing. It really does. I look forward to prepping our beds every year and just getting in that dirt and getting the soil ready and the process of planting. And then to see this miraculous process of life blossoming, you know, before your very eyes from a seed, to see this incredible living thing come up, and then to be able to harvest and eat a salad, you know, or stir fry some vegetables. And there's nothing more satisfying than that, you know, culinarily speaking. It's incredible.
I'd like to say that if you're up for the challenge, try, as you're ready to sit down and eat this beautiful veggie mix that you've grown, thank that vegetable for growing, for giving of its life, for its life force, its nutrients, its nourishment. You know, the studies of Masanobu Fukuoka, that's the wrong Japanese. Who's the water molecule?
The messages in water guy.
Messages in water.
Uh-huh. We can Google it and find out. The guy that does the book on the messages in water, yeah.
Which, just to recap,
speaking a lovely thank you, some kind of gratitude, changes those water crystals into a beautiful form, saying something hateful or hurtful, makes those water crystals kind of ugly and not all that they could be. So can you imagine what you're doing to your food as you thank and appreciate that Swiss chard or that carrot for growing, for giving to you, giving its very body to you, knowing the whole time it would be harvested, just purely that generosity of nature. What you are doing for the life force that you are taking into your body. So try the experiment.
Dr. Masaru Emoto.
Emoto.
And there's YouTube videos. You can watch how the effect of various people. It was in that movie that I'm blanking on right now. But anyway, the images in on the YouTube video are of people saying or imagining or thinking certain words and how it affects the water molecules, and it's pretty profound, so it's definitely worth watching that.
And you know, this is not that much of a stretch. I mean, there's a reason why all the great spiritual traditions, at least that I'm aware of, have some form of grace that's said over a meal. You know, it's certainly in our family growing up in a Judeo-Christian tradition, and friends of ours who are Sufi in the Muslim tradition, it's a very essential part of the meal, coming together and taking a moment to pause with gratitude. And I think it's a very powerful, palpable, if it's done sincerely. It's not just, you know.
Well, and the people who are allowed to be the chefs in certain spiritual traditions are,
tradition.
You know, in Buddhist traditions, they don't just hire anybody to be the chef because you're eating the energy that's being imbued into the food when the chef is cooking. So there's definitely an understanding of that piece, too. Whoever's doing the cooking is creating a particular vibration in the food as well. And if you look at even how food is chopped and what instruments are used to chop the food and what direction you chop the food, I mean, you can get really into how and all the different aspects of how food is prepared and what kind of nourishing meal you get at the end of it. So I would much rather eat food that was prepared by
lovingly.
A happy, loving, positive chef than a chef who's having in a bad mood.
And you know,
and you big cabbage radio fans, you know the restaurant Turkey Red, and if you've ever peeked in on the owner Alex Papasavas as she starts preparing food, she puts that knife in her hand, and the piece of food, whether it's meat or vegetable or whatever, and there's always that tremendous respect. You could just tell what Alex is radiating with her consciousness. as she begins to prepare food. It's just a beautiful thing. We are so lucky to have her.
We are. We really are. I love that you're using the word consciousness, because this is really what seems to be permeating your entire message, is bringing a degree of intention and intentionality and deeper consciousness to what we're doing, and opening up a very holistic, deeply integrated relationship to what we're actually doing in all of life. And then the result is dramatic. It's not subtle. It's quite powerful.
And I also want to say that, you know, we describe this hour as being a discussion, you know, with the master gardener talking about the secrets of gardening. And it sounds like one of the secrets is to be conscious and to be aware and to notice things and to pay attention. I mean, that sounds like that's the biggest secret of all, is to really be aware and ask questions and come into the gardening experience not from a place of, I know it all because I read it in a book and this is how you do it, but to consciously approach your space, look at what you have, look at what's going on in nature around your space, you know, have some sense of what's going on in your soil, and come from that place of like wanting to learn and being willing to not only give to the soil, but also, you know, hear what the soil has to say to you, hear what the plants are saying to you, and you'll have a very different garden.
So my true confession would be, you asked before about what amendments do you use, Ellie? What about this consciousness and what about nutrient density? You'll find me quietly sitting and thinking about how much I love soil and then asking to be in conscious connection with the angel of soil or deva of soil or consciousness of soil or essence of soil, whatever term you like. And I have a list in front of me, and I'll go down the checklist. What do you need, dear soil, in my particular garden? Our particular garden, since this is a shared venture, the garden and I, to be producing nutrient-dense vegetables that are healthy and vibrant and full of life force. Do you need nitrogen this year? Almost every year you need to add nitrogen. Yes. I'll get a sense of yes. Okay, what form? I can provide either fish bone meal or liquid fish or, say, cottonseed meal. I'll list three or four that I know that I can get easily and are affordable. And what suits you best? All right. Do you need phosphorus? In what form? I can get it in, provided in fish bone meal, or rock phosphate. What's best for you this year? Okay. How much? What could you give it to me, please, in 100 square foot sections? And then when I get all done with the NPK and trace minerals and, you know, the calcium and that sort of thing, then I'll say, is there anything else? And I might get something like, yes, the past owners were of this kind of energy and attitude, and could you please give us some mint tea that would help balance out whatever that was? Could you please give us some Artemisia tea? Don't worry about the dosage. Just put it in your sprayer and spread it around. Pretty good concentration sprayer to get over the whole garden, and that'll do it.
And this is all intuitively coming back to you in some way as you open yourself up to this dialogue, this relationship.
That's why you take Sam and Kevin's meditation class. You can get to that heart space where you feel calm, centered, and you think how much you love vegetables fresh, how much you love your soil. And you start asking, and some people feel a sensation in their body when they ask yes-no questions. Some people don't feel it in their body and have to use a pendulum, which is me for the time being. Any of these will do. I can show you a few other methods. I would love to have you in a class and show you how to do this kind of thing and give you the check sheet. It's great fun, and then you feel like, aha, There's many kinds and many forms of amendments one could dump on, but now I feel like it's not just what the soil test said, but what the soil here on my land says it truly needs for what I've asked for a goal. And they want to know your goal. So it may be a little bit different, within range, but a little different from what the charts say.
So what's the most surprising thing your soil ever asked for?
I didn't expect mint tea.
Mint tea is kind of interesting. I think I've, I knew somebody who told me that pennyroyal was good for mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And she was using some sort of combination of mint tea. She was allergic to several different, well, pretty much everything. So the pennyroyal, the extraction from that was actually helpful to keep the bugs away while she was in the garden. So I wonder if there was some sort of anti-pathogenic aspect of the mint. I think of it as a digestive herb, so maybe something to soothe a soil that's upset, to calm it down a little bit.
I'm scared if I'm scaring you as gardeners to think, oh, now I have more complications. I have to go through a whole list of herbal teas to give to my garden. No, please do the basics first of just a soil test and your basic amendments or fish and kelp. If you're ready to grow in this way of tuning in and asking, when I described the mint and the artemisia, it was to deal with overall energy left by other people in that garden that I inherited, and we're shifting some energy or helping it clear of some attitudes that are holding back its full potential. It's like you taking a floral essence. We're not talking nutrients, and we're not talking a specific pest repellent. We're talking helping you adjust your energy balances. So that's sort of an advanced thing, and please don't be scared off by that. But if you're ready to learn that and you know what you're doing already with basic gardening, oh, come on over. We'll have some fun.
And this is subtle levels of terrain. You know, when I always talk to people in acupuncture about how we're wanting to prepare the terrain so that, you know, that the person can be healthy. And so you would never walk out onto your garden, you know, June 1st and just toss the seeds every which way and go, okay, you're on your own until August. There's a lot of work that you need to do on a macro level. And there's a lot of things that, you know, so, and once you get those macro things worked out, you know, then there are some micro level things, some fine-tuning that the soil might need. And so you're talking about the level on the fine-tuning of the soil. The macronutrients, the micronutrients might be there, but then there's some a little bit, oh, we tweak this a little bit or tweak that a little bit, and things might go better, and you might get more nutrient-dense. I mean, not might, you will get more. will get more nutrient-dense or more nourishing foods from that.
So organic matter, your soil biology, and all of that.
We're coming down to the last minute here. Any last things you want to share with the listeners and how they follow up with you and what classes you have coming up?
Yeah, we have a seed starting class that you just come. I bring everything, and the potting media that I recommend, the cell packs that I recommend, various seeds, and you can go home with two flats all planted of flowers and vegetables, and I'll talk you through what you do as far as watering, hardening off, transplanting. There's worm composting classes. If you can't make it to the acupuncture center, then come to one of the two others that are offered at Artemisia Acres, which is my Good Earth Garden School site. And we've been talking about some of the subtle energy stuff. Liz Holmgren in Anchorage is teaching a course called Pranic Gardens, named after prana, the life force, and the communication between the veils. Boy, you can really go for it in that one.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us on Bridge to Everywhere. You've been listening to us speaking with Ellie Vandeweis, the compost queen, and have a wonderful evening, everybody.
That's www.goodearthgardenschool.com. Is that right?
Yes.
Great.
Have a
okay.
great night.
Thanks, Ellie.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska.
Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.